G'day Gladys, Elena Katz-Chernin, and I welcome you to LNL. As Bette Davis famously said in All About Eve, fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Now, I say this because I've already had a bumpy ride with my next guest, one of the most memorable in decades of sitting at microphones chatting to people. War horse, well, he might object to that, so let's introduce him as a peace horse, a warrior for peace, and he brings with him a healthy dose of what he calls professorial arrogance. Now, immediately after he last appeared on LNL, we got an avalanche of emails and phone calls, some outraged at what they'd heard, but most desperate to hear more. The peace horse's name is Professor Johan Galtung, and he took part in a discussion with Michael Costello about Iraq, and such was the response that I asked him if he'd come back to speak more extensively about conflict resolution. Let me quote you some prose of his. Peace appeals to the heart, studies to the brain. Both are needed, indeed indispensable. But equally indispensable is a valid link between brain and heart. And that, in a nutshell, is what peace studies and peace practice are all about. Johan Galtung just about invented peace studies, been at it for decades, won an honorary prize in his hometown of Oslo. It's known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. At last count, he's been working on real conflict resolution in five continents. He's got a dozen major positions, over 30 visiting professorships, oodles of books, and 1,000 published monographs. Now, I began our conversation by saying that I was trying to get my head around the idea of negotiating to head off war and was trying to find an example, an instance where it seemed to have worked. And I mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, which seemed to be one occasion when the world was right on the edge of disaster, both sides trying to extricate themselves from a situation that had its own relentless momentum, when all of a sudden, negotiations, very secret negotiations, via a backdoor approach occurred, and we're all alive today to talk about it.
It was October 1962, Philip. I myself had been to Havana in September and was one of the first to know about the missiles because the opposition to Castro told me about it. I brought out the news, reported it to the Norwegian ambassador, who then deposited it with my foreign ministry. And that was much before this got public. I had a hunch, and my hunch was this. The reason why the Soviet Union is placing missiles in Havana, 90 miles away from Florida, it's because the United States has done the same in Turkey, 0 miles away from the Soviet Union. So it is balance, it's quid pro quo, tit pro tat. You think you have a right to use your ally, we have the right to use our ally. You think you have the right to sacrifice your ally in a confrontation, we have the right to sacrifice ours. So this was the symmetry game that was going on. Now that was the key to the peace. We withdraw our missiles if you withdraw yours. That's what happened.
But we weren't to know that's what happened.
We were not to know it because
the
United States,
for a long time.
The United States is an Anglo-Saxon country. I don't think Anglo-Saxons are very good at admitting mistakes. And I don't think they're very good at doing anything that might be interpreted as them being weak. So this idea of being weak is what they were afraid of. That means the United States couldn't show publicly that they were giving in on something. They tried to make it look as if the Soviet Union suddenly saw the light, that they were confronted with a superpower bigger than their own, and that's the reason why the ships turned around. Now, when the ships turned around, the missiles had already been there. They were already there, so these were fresh supplies ships.
You made the point in our previous conversation that when governments say, we will not negotiate with these people, that's when they're negotiating.
Oh yes, when they say never, they never take never for an ever, I would say. That's because the thought is so high up from their subconscious to their conscious that they have to kill it publicly all the time. Because they know there is no other way out. And they will enter into it. I am only, so to speak, praying to my peace gods. They're not Christian necessarily, neither Islamic. Maybe they're more Buddhist of a type. I am praying to them that they have already started and have the sense to have good advices for it.
In that situation we're discussing, you had a balance of terror, but you also had in some strange way a balance of interest in that neither Khrushchev nor Kennedy wanted the world to go to war. Michael Costello, in protesting your line of argument, and we'll get into this shortly in more detail, in protesting your line of argument in relation to the so-called war against terror, says what happens when the enemy is like Al-Qaeda, although I must say that you've suggested that even Al-Qaeda is a sort of a figment of the diplomatic or propaganda.
It's a kind of nebulous thing.
But what happens when the enemy is implacable?
Difficult. Let's put it this way. The enemy always has his small, tiny fault lines. There may be one part that is less implacable than another. You seek the internal contradictions. You work it from upside down. I can tell you something I do, because I've been mediating in about 50 conflicts, and I've been called high up, low down, all kinds of places. I'm heading an NGO called Transcend. Maybe the foreign minister or the prime minister is not interested in talking with me. Maybe the young female assistant of the deputy foreign minister is. Not as a man-woman kind of thing, but because she's ambitious and she has a feeling that something is wrong. And maybe she would like to have some arguments. So maybe we meet, maybe we have a dialogue. Maybe she tells a lot of things of the reality of the system, and I tell a lot of things about the possibilities, the potentials. So that's one way. But there is another way, which is the best. And that is terribly difficult. But it is to show the so-called implacable enemy that there is something in the world better than for him to be implacable. That it could be a both and, as we say. The Americans often call it win-win. I don't like that expression, but it is in that direction. In other words, that there would be a place for him. And the place might be better than he thinks. Philip, let me give an example. The Palestinians and the Israelis see each other as pretty implacable. I myself, as I dare say, a specialist in the field, having been countless times to the area also, am convinced there will be no peace between Israel and Palestine for the simple reason that Israel is too strong and Palestine is too small. Peace has a balance. There is a kind of symmetry in it. But imagine a Middle East community where you suddenly have Syria, Lebanon, recognized Palestine, Jordan, the arrogant Egypt on one hand, and on the other side, the strong Israel with all its resources and big brother to draw upon and things like that. Suddenly there is a balance of peace, not a military balance. And I could see culture blossoming, the economy blossoming, political cooperation, some kind of confederation, in short, the European community as a model transplanted to the Middle East. Okay, imagine you are able to make this take life in the minds of the implacable people. They may never yield to it, but their assistants may. They may say, and they have whispered to me a couple of times, wait till the old guy dies. This is the way out. I've heard that one. Dies doesn't mean biologically. It could mean socially in a benign retirement.
What happened between the French and the Algerians? People often draw that as a hopeful indicator that he was two implacable enemies. But de Gaulle had the audacity, the cheek, the daring to actually say, well, to hell with this, enough is enough.
He was a genius, and he was strong. And that was 1962. It was in Evian. And one part of his trick was that he offered to the Pieds Noirs, as they were called, the French Algerians, most of them, more than 90%, born in Algeria. It was their home. And they were frightened to death by the Long Knives revenge, because they had killed about 1 million of them, you see. So they had something to fear. Now, one of the solutions was to offer them access to southern France and just come. And they came by droves, enormous quantities of them, escaping. And after a short while, most of them returned to Algeria. So it was the safety valve approach. Worked extremely well.
This is LNL, Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, and it is my great honour to be talking to Johan Geltung, who has been involved, as you said, in so many conflicts, more conflicts than we've had hot breakfasts. Let me mention or raise a couple of them, which seem beyond redemption, beyond any possibility of a fix. North and South Korea.
I've been working very much on that one. I have been in Pyongyang, in Seoul, back and forth. I've even done some shuttling. Let me first point to one thing. I talk about unification. Well, if you unify the two states, there will be one president less. North Korea was of the opinion that should be the South Korean president, because they saw Kim Il-sung as the liberator of the country, and not unjustifiably so. By the age 1912, by the age of 18 or something, he was trampling up the whole half of the peninsula and established his guerrilla forces at the border to China. We'll not go into that. I'll just say that it is a heroic thing he did, which has not been sufficiently understood. But if we talk about unification of the nation, then it makes sense. You keep the two states for the time being, but you make the border open and osmotic. So a guy like me, I was among the first to talk about a train, opening the train, opening the road connection, let things flow and float, back and forth, persons, ideas, goods, whatever. In other words, you work on the whole infrastructure.
But when the North Koreans seem to have a great fear of ideas, why would they be agreeable to this?
They're not so terribly afraid of ideas, because they think their own ideas are superior. You see, they have the arrogance of faith. If I should now engage in some rash generalizations, there's a Korean concept, Philip, called Han, which means resentment. Koreans are much of that. I am offended. I, in the collective, meaning we, are offended. Now, at the same time, Koreans are good missionaries. They have very strong faiths.
Well, Kim Il-sung and the Moonies come to mind.
Precisely, you got it exactly right. They are two sides of the same coin. There's only a slight difference in the faith. And the way they orchestrate it with ballast and fireworks and colors, it's fantastic, it's magnificent. Absolutely. Now, the point about it is that if you are full of being offended and you are a missionary and you want to preach to surrounding countries, then you have a bad luck, because China, Soviet Union or Russia and Japan, they're not going to listen to a Korean coming to preach to them. Then somebody divide them into two parts, whereupon they start engaging in evangelizing each other. And this is a game they have been doing for some time. And it, of course, accentuates the conflict and makes it worse, because it plays up the fundamentalists on both sides. Now, in North Korea, you have this interesting division between the hardliners and the softer. And you'll see the hardliners suddenly attacking a Japanese fishing boat. Now, there's something a little bit strange about some of those fishing boats. I'll not go into that. And next week, somebody's apologizing.
You mean they're bristling with aerials?
I would say that the aerials look to me like they're fishing signals and not fish. And I'm not a specialist on it, but I've seen some photos of them that are kind of revealing. Or you have the Pueblo ship, you know, and all of that. So, all kinds of things. But you have one of them abducting Japanese civilians on the coast close to Niigata, and then you have the other one apologizing for it. Now, you can imagine they've had some stormy meeting in the Politburo to sort out that one. Sometimes it's the same person. So, don't let us make them too monolithic. The South Koreans don't. They understand it. But they have the basic problem that Big Brother US is keeping a nuclear base in South Korea.
I want to get on to the immense conflict between the Christian West and the world of Islam. And I like the way you put it into a vast historical context. Let's look at another area in which you've been involved, which also has a long prehistory. People don't think of the of what happened in the past, and in the constant preoccupation with now. No one thinks about Libya and Gaddafi in terms of what the Italians did to the place
under Mussolini. And in 1911, let me just insert that one, it was the first time a military plane bombed civilians, done by Italians against an oasis close to Tripoli, killing women and children.
Now, this is a part of the collective memory, isn't it, of the Libyan people?
I haven't found a person in that country who doesn't know it. I haven't found a person in Italy who knows it. I'm at home in Italy, speak the language. I'm at home as I am in my own country. I haven't found a single one. I'm giving lectures on it in Italy to Italians.
Johan, I'm always trying to tell people about this, that we've got to look back and back and back to understand now. And that's why I want to talk to you about...
Islam, Christianity.
I want to talk to you about Yugoslavia. This is an area where you've been active.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, has an appalling prehistory. I know of a couple of hundred years of it. You probably know much more. So if we're dealing with the conflict between Serb and Croat, or any of the conflicts in the Balkans, you've got to deal with all of it, don't you? You've got to go back to the mythologies and the tensions that have created the history.
There's no way of getting around it. I was for 4 years Director General of Yugoslavia's International University in Dubrovnik, and it was my task to mediate, if you will. There were 6 states and 8 nations, to put it that way, because you also had the Hungarians and the Albanians in the state of Serbia, or the Republic of Serbia. Well, it introduced me to it. You are talking about 900 years quite often, and if you go back to one crucial date, which is, of course, the 28th of June, 1389, the Battle of Kosovo, in Albanian pronunciation, but the Turks came up and conquered Serbia. Now, how do the Serbs react to that? Well, they have something which I put in a very simple form. Defeat, retreat, return. And you can read their myths, you can listen to their songs, see their paintings. The defeat is a part of it, the retreat is a part of it, the return is a part of it. Well, right now they were defeated by American bombing. And the bombing was essentially against civilians and against state factories. Their smart bombs had a particular nose for public state factories, but not for private factories, which is quite interesting. I guess that's a part of the smartness. They capitulated. Well, that's a defeat. They have been retreating. They're convinced they will return. It's a part of it. This is a phase. They're used to it. Philip, I was consultant to the Reconciliation Commission they are setting up. And I think we all agree on one thing, that to pin it on Milosevic is simply stupidity. Complete stupidity. He's a little tiny functionary. I happen to know about him. And for him to be appointed Satan for a short period was a big surprise for him. He's not quite up to it. If you want to look for a Satan, it's the Serbian culture, the myths. Now, we don't have any legal experience in how to arraign a myth into court. So, you know, we have a problem there. And this is what we are in peace studies, you see, this collective psychotherapy. When you're suffering from excessive megalomania and paranoia, and Anglo-Saxons are a party to that, then where is the psychotherapy? Well, the paranoia means that whenever you see a tiny threat, you exaggerate it immensely, like the Anglo-Saxon nation is doing right now. Now, you'll have noticed that Canada and New Zealand are opting out. Interesting. Spain was joining, and we know what happened to Spain in that connection. The others aim for something similar. That means that there would be a need for therapy for those who are suffering from excessive visions of glory and trauma. The Serbs are among them. The Iraqis are among them. And their traumas, you mentioned that you have to go back to it. Well, 1258 is the big year. And I must say with professorial arrogance that the person who talks about Iraq without knowing 1258 She'd keep silent and go to a library first.
The professorial arrogance of Johann Galtung.
As hereby been demonstrated.
Is my guest on LNL, Radio National Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. I've always been exasperated by any suggestion that the war, the so-called war against terror, begins on September the 11th, a couple of years ago.
It's ridiculous. I mean, here you have a president of the United States trying to introduce a new thing in philosophy, namely the a-causal event, the event which has no cause. By that time, they've had 67 military interventions after the Second World War and about 235 after they started in 1804-05. That was Thomas Jefferson in Libya. They have killed, after the Second World War, about 12 to 16 million people. Now, to imagine that there wouldn't be somebody who has a little tiny itch of revenge in him would be a little bit naive, I think. So that's one factor. But it's only one factor, because what we do in these kind of studies is whenever we see or hear or know an act of violence, we ask what's the underlying conflict. In other words, we see the violence as a monument of an unresolved conflict. Now, what's the conflict? Okay, I asked people in the State Department, what do you want? And I asked people close to Al-Qaeda, what do you want? The first actor answered free trade. The other one answered respect. It's an incompatibility there, because if you are excessively free in your trade, you may trample on sensitivities. You may also bring in military bases to protect your so-called free trade.
Well, that's certainly true of cultural trade. The so-called soft power of America is often one of the most abrasive and inflammatory dimensions, because it is so confronting to other cultures.
That's very true, but they object even more to, and you may be surprised about that, what they object to in a supermarket is not necessarily the goods, but it is the way you treat the person with whom you... the cashier. Because in the Quran, a very basic aspect of Islam is that buying and selling is not a monetary operation. It's not a product one way and a cash or credit card the other way. It's a human relation. I've been myself in souks in Northern Africa, marketplaces, where I wanted to buy a carpet. And the guy said, would you like to have a cup of tea? Now, here's a photo of my wife. Could I see a photo of your family?
I know it well. I know this experience.
You've been
well.
Through it all.
And it's delightful. It's time-consuming.
But exactly. And in the end, I said, I'm sorry. Could we agree on a price? Because my plane is leaving. And he said, next time. Next time, he said. I find it fantastic. And I have grown up to appreciate it immensely. You know, the way we do it, we hardly even have eye contact with that girl handling that enormous amount of information, pushing buttons, nervous to make mistakes. And there is certainly no exchange of photos of the boyfriend or whatever. You see, they see that as an insult to humanity in you, that your whole divine character is reduced to nothing. So if you train yourself in seeing it with those eyes, then you see better what it is about.
What date would you select out of the great saga of history to begin the conflict between what is loosely now called Islam and Christianity?
You can select many. Of course, it didn't help the slightest for Christianity to be told that Jesus Christ was only one prophet, what in Islam is called a Nabi. In the Quran, he's called Isa, and Moses is called Musa. And they are Nabi, that means announcers before the prophet. Prophet is Rasul, Muhammad. That's the real one. Now, the Christians didn't like that at all, but otherwise Islam and Christianity, almost identical. Some people have said that Islam is Christianity without Christology. But if we now go to events, I focused on 1258. That was a part of the Crusades. It was the massacre of Baghdad. So that was the Christian Pope who had gotten into an alliance with the grandson of Genghis Khan, Hulaku. And according to some accounts, he killed 1 million Muslims in Baghdad and saved all the Christians by the agreement. Okay, he came with rapid, quick horses. When the war in 1991 came, I think it started about the 27th of January, when that one came, For the Iraqis, there was no doubt. The name of Hulaku is George Bush. Instead of horses, he uses missiles. The Christians are, of course, all around, and they're in a coalition, so-called US-led coalition. And that is the way, as you said, metaphor, that's the way you interpret things. Now, this is more real than forces and tanks and things of that kind. And that is why I don't have much respect intellectually for so-called realists who are only able to count weapons.
How do we deal with a Western world which has, and its media, which has a very short attention span, very little grasp of history, which tends to look down the bonnet rather than the rear vision mirror,
mm-hmm.
and keeps its foot on the accelerator? How do you deal with people who lack historical perspective?
Well, you cannot go on teaching history. That takes too much time. I try to get around it. Let me give an example of a successful mediation, very quickly told. Ecuador, Peru, up in the Andes. They had a war in 1941. Ecuador lost one-third of its territory. They drew a new border. They couldn't draw it in the Andes because they didn't have maps. 500 square kilometers contested. They had three wars. They went on 54 years. And then somebody organized a meeting between myself and the Ecuadorian president. Now, I have lived in Latin America many years. I talk Spanish like I talk English, and I know the history of the region, and I know this conflict. So the president asked me, ex-president at that time, actually, asked me, what's your proposal? I know one thing, that if you go too much into the past, you get understanding, but you don't find a solution. Because if the solution is located in the past, they probably would already have found it. So you have to take a creative jump into the future. And I said, you people have had two wars about where to draw the border. How about forgetting about that border and have a binational zone with a natural park? Now, that's a jump. He said, Professor Galtung, very creative, but too creative. I have been in these negotiations for 30 years. Nobody has ever proposed that. It's not that fantastic, so it's a little bit disappointing. It'll take 30 years to get used to the idea and 30 more years to put it into practice. Now, it took 3 years. Why is that? Because younger people in the presidency, as far as I've been told, said, we take it. We take it, and the pact, the treaty, was signed in 1998, in September. Now, that conflict doesn't belong to me, it belongs to them. But people get stuck. And they get stuck because of their history. They had been searching for some precedent in the relationship between the viceroy in Peru and the lower-ranking official in what became Quito and things of that kind and in Bogotá, and try to see if they could find something there. You can imagine the number of PhD theses. It became an industry. So you take a jump that, in a sense, tells you, let us look forward. Now, you have to tidy up the past. You have to reconcile. That was my recommendation. They haven't done it, and I'm afraid of that. Because people were killed. Thousands were killed. You have to reconcile. Thousands of killed means 10,000s are bereaved who had a feeling that their sons died in vain, because they wanted that territory for themselves. You have to make it a very viable peace. They're doing a good job at that one, a bad job at reconciliation.
Before we came on air, you and I were talking about the benefactions of getting older. You're now, mid-70s. You like this because, you've got nothing to prove and you don't really care a damn who you offend, and you've got a lot of mileage on the clock. With all the pain, the suffering, the failures of conciliation that you've observed, do you have any optimism, or now are
yes,
you...
I do. Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes, I do. I was saying, it's something to do with the word peace studies. Imagine you meet that handicapped person who tells you, I'm 1% handicapped and 99% healthy. That guy will live long. If you meet the guy who says, I'm handicapped, full stop, the life expectancy is short. Now, When I look around the world, I find 99% peace and 1% war and violence. I find people, by and large, being quite kind and good to each other, or at least living together in a decent way. You could take Australia as an example. Australia is the master country in the world of having an enjoyable life. Australian hedonism is the national...
You said hedonism, not heathenism, didn't you?
Well.
Well, that is our religion, hedonism, really.
It's a religion, and I use it positively. The capacity for enjoyment. You have wine hedonism, picnic hedonism, cultural hedonism, intellectual hedonism, music hedonism. I would imagine you have sexual hedonism, too. I have neither participation.
Well, not personally, no,
certainly not. But you see, the point about it is this. There is a lot of peace around. There are some pockets of incapability, of clumsy handling of conflict. Yugoslavia was very badly handled. 9/11 is badly handled. Iraq is badly handled. Afghanistan. But these are things that, in a sense, are bad islets in an ocean of peace. So that gives me the optimism.
It's a point that A.J.P. Taylor made towards the end of his life. He said, never in the history of the world has there been such all-pervasive peace.
Precisely.
Never have so many people lived in something approaching freedom before.
Well, you see, A.J.P. is a person I respect very much, and I dare say there are some similarities in character.
Mm. Well, look, I want to know about you now, in the time we've got left. First of all, let me ask you about your strange little country. All I know about Norway is it's about the size of New Zealand, about the same population, and it has a couple of languages, as I understand, an urban and a rural. Why does it fight above its weight so successfully? Why does Norway make such a disproportionate contribution to political discourse?
We have two good experiences. We have a fairly decent society. Fairly decent, with no misery, no excessively rich country. It's changing now, because people are unfortunately dismantling a welfare state that functioned very well. But by and large, that was a very positive experience. I grew up in that. And if you know something is, then it is also possible. And I'm old enough at the age of 73 to, as a child, have seen massive misery in my own country. It was a two-class country. It became a one-class country under the masterful leadership of one particular prime minister, Einar Gerhardsen was his name, and his wife. Now, the second good experience is the Nordic community. You see, what we hear once in a while is that, not strange that you people are so peaceful, you don't have real passion, you're blood, you don't have blood, you have water in your veins or something of the kind. Okay, if you have extravagant enough not to know history, but I could tell you a little bit about over 600, 700, 800 years of warfare. Somehow, we came to an end of that. And there was a Nordic, and is a Nordic community, where war is unthinkable. We have so many mechanisms for handling conflict. So imagine now you have to grow up in that, you see. Unfortunately, we can also become arrogant missionaries. Why aren't you good Scandinavians, all of you people? It happens to us. Try to avoid it. We try to understand also that we had some lucky circumstances. We had homogeneous societies. My own country
is that luck? Because in saying that, the enemies of reason might seize upon it. Those who believe that it is impossible to have a multi-ethnic or a multicultural society that works.
It made it easier for us. And yet we treated our small minority Samis, we treated them abominably, absolutely abominably. And I immediately take up your argument, Philip. It's a very important one, because it makes us often blind to the difficulties that other countries have and to the enrichment of multi-ethnicism. So right now, there is a struggle in Norway over that. And the capacity to receive asylum seekers from abroad is about as high as the capacity to deal decently with Tampa. Tampa, by chance, was a Norwegian ship.
That is not lost upon me, or any of the people.
I'm not trying to cash in on it. But I noticed what the captain said. He was doing nothing particularly missionary. He was just doing what a decent captain would have done according to international law. So somebody else did something.
Okay, that's the country. What about you? How did you happen?
I grew up with the conscience and the awareness that this is possible as a source of inspiration. And as a very young man, I was a student politician at the age of 19, running around with an attaché case, and got to know the world, because the languages have never been my problem. I speak quite a lot of them. And you see, what happened then was that I was called into military service. And my father, the politician, the physician, had told me, be conscious about whatever you decide in life, Johan. So I decided to find out whether that was a good idea. I read all the literature, anti-war literature, and it was not good enough for me, because I was interested in peace more than just anti-war. Anti-war I took for granted. It was how to be pro-peace. Remember, we had been through 5 years of Nazi occupation, my father in concentration camp and all that. I was at a place, it was in Helsinki, and I had decided that I have to read some book in peace studies. So I went to the library to get a book in peace studies. And after some search, the librarian said, strangely enough, the field doesn't seem to exist. Okay, that was the day I got my mission in life.
Ah, there's a niche market, isn't there?
There is a niche market. Yeah. Well, the first book in peace studies in Finnish, called Rohan Titkumus, was written by me and came in 1967. Now, I protest a little bit. Let us call it an intellectual challenge. Mm. I had the intellectual tools.
You were a mathematician.
A mathematician. That's not a bad background.
Why isn't it a bad background? Disciplines. It's a language I do not speak.
Let me give you two points about mathematics. You buy into a branch of mathematics and you are disciplined, you follow the rules. When you come to the point you bang your head against the wall, you create a new mathematics, which also has its rules. So you're both disciplined and damn creative. Mm. It's not a bad training, you see. Mm. Any mathematician listening to this will be nodding.
Okay, that's how this extraordinary fellow, Johan Galtung, appears.
I'm just doing what somehow was my fate to do, but I'll say one word about being Norwegian. It has the advantage that Norwegians don't have too many characteristics, so that we are, as an African president once told me, you're like jellyfish. Jellyfish? What do you mean, jellyfish? Well, you're just out there and you probably do something, we don't know exactly what, but nobody watches you. Now, that's the advantage and it's the disadvantage.
This is what flows out of Oslo around the world again and again and again. Oslo's on the map when it comes to conflict resolution. This comes out of the national culture and out of your own...
It comes out of the national culture.
Your own energies.
I am not convinced that my foreign ministry gets it right. I think they make mistakes, but the spirit comes, and the spirit is good.
Okay, let's use that spirit now in this world where 91-92% of it's not in bad shape and a few percents are in a terrible mess. Let's look at some of the things you raised when we were discussing these issues with Michael Costello. Some of the things that really got people's back up, because while I was inundated with the emails and letters of approval about you, there was also quite a lot of intense disapproval.
I'm used to that, sir. I've been experiencing that the last 50 years.
One of the things that made people cross was you suggested that Al-Qaeda is, in a sense, a fantasy, a piece of contemporary mythology created by people in the West because it suits them. Can you talk to that?
Well, they couldn't have heard what I said, because I said it's much worse than that. You're up against 1.3 billion Muslims who by their faith are committed to defend their faith when trampled upon by the sword. The sword today has a little bit different shape. But I did say that Al-Qaeda is a big pyramidal concept.
Say that again. It's a
big pyramidal concept, a pyramid, a hierarchy with one man at the top, constructed like the Pentagon, which has the U.S. president at the top. That organization does not exist. It is much worse, much more dangerous. You just listen to Egyptian experts on this thing, and they'll tell you it's a multiplicity of cells all over. They need very little coordination. 9/11 cost only $400,000, a trifle. You don't need the Bin Laden millions to do that. This is just Americans making it easy for themselves by thinking they'll get away with it by capturing or killing one man and drying up the credit cards.
It's a bit like the FBI construct of a centralized mafia, isn't it? Makes it easy to talk about crime.
Precisely.
When in fact it's disorganized or unorganized crime that's the greater problem.
And any real capable mafia, like any resistance movement against, be it Stalinism or Hitlerism, knows that we have to be organized horizontally, and one cell shouldn't know too much about the other because you might be tortured. Like in Guantanamo.
Like in Guantanamo, yeah.
Now, I think your callers have been a little bit too addicted to the usual Anglo-Saxon press presentation of it. By the way, I was told that Al-Qaeda changed names 2 years ago. Al-Qaeda means the base, and the new name is not much more promising.
I would say... far more emphatic.
It doesn't
concerning.
Sound better. It
no,
doesn't
it does
sound
not.
Better. But you have to understand what that law is. I mean, wherever you go, they talk about being trampled upon. Let's go back for a second to 1945, to the treaty between President Roosevelt and Ibn Saud. I think it was on board an aircraft carrier in the Suez Canal. It was just like after the Yalta conference. 2 points. The oil resources on Saudi Arabia available to U.S. exploitation. Point two, the U.S. commits itself to defend the royal house against its own population. Now, why is that? Well, Wahhabism is the religion of Saudi Arabia. It's shared by the royal house, the clerics, the population, Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and is one of the most rapidly expanding branches of Islam. Now, that one preaches asceticism. There must be only one religion, one faith in the sacred land. We are the chosen people. In other words, everybody who is not with us is with the enemy.
Gosh, so suddenly that sounds a bit like George Bush.
Well, I call him George Bin Laden, actually, or Osama Bush. I mean, they could exchange speeches if they wanted to. Or since I'm a little bit specialist on fundamentalism, I could write them for them if they pay me sufficiently for peace work. Now, if you go into this, you can see the whole operation of the oil industry and the military bases in Saudi Arabia as trampling upon them. And they've been saying this without interruption all the time, but of course the Royal House were the opposite party, the party that the United States was dealing with. And they are split down the middle. They are split on the king and the opposition to the king inside the family, who is with the Wahhabs. And that split leads to a very, very difficult situation for all of them, all parties involved. It's taken much time for the U.S. to understand the situation. And I still don't think they do.
In your dealings with the State Department, do you find some lucid, well-informed, profoundly intelligent Americans who do understand?
They're usually retired, resigned, or dismissed. There have been brilliant examples of U.S. diplomats. I think they got rid of the last Arab on the Middle East desk a couple of years ago.
Oh, you can't have Arabs on the Middle East desk.
Of course not.
Yeah, don't be silly.
And that is what they did with China, you know. They got rid of all the experts. And I found brilliant people. And absolutely compassionate, fine people. But I found the opposite too. Just hacks. And the investigation that came out of the paper by a lieutenant colonel who left Pentagon and has now published how the Pentagon produces position papers is very revealing. I mean, right now they are in the hands of the group of people who wrote the project for the New American Century. In other words, they occupied. And I know a better State Department than that one.
Johann, we talked about ancient history. You make the point that if there was an answer in history, that answer would have been found, and we're talking generally about various conflict models. We're talking about a super state versus a religious view, a living and palpable set of religious beliefs. We're talking about decentralized cells. How the hell do you begin the process of conflict resolution in such to use a jargon term, such an asymmetric world.
Mm. That superpower is extremely vulnerable, as is Spain, as is Australia, as are the 12 countries that have military jobs in connection with the Iraq campaign. Very vulnerable, the Western societies. In other words, you can have as much weapons as you want. You can have destructive power D. You have to subtract the vulnerability V. D minus V, that's your power. You might find your power is negative. So, in that situation, that
I'm sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt. You might find your power is negative. In other words, you've got power you can't deploy or use.
You have more vulnerability you're able to destroy on the other side. In other words, the other side can, with fairly simple means, destroy more than you can destroy with him. And that's the situation in which we are to a large extent. And you can have as many intelligence services or non-intelligence disservices or whatever you'd like to call them. These are clever people. And whenever the intelligence services discover a way of defending themselves, they'll discover a way of getting around that one. Now, this calls for negotiation, and you know, the simplest type of negotiation you could have would be simply to say, would it be possible that we agree on a little deal? We withdraw our troops, and you don't attack us.
Ah, we're getting back to where we started. We're getting back to something like a Cuban model.
We are doing that. And this is what the new Spanish government has announced they will do by June. Unless the Spanish troops, 1,300 in numbers, about the same numbers as the Australian troops, will be under UN command. In other words, US out, UN in. Now, that is not an unwise position by the new government. It's very different from the government that very unwisely tried to push it on ETA. Now, you can imagine US simply going in saying, under President Kerry, probably the next president, you stop attacking us, we withdraw our bases from Muslim countries that want us out. But we want some kind of proof that they want us out. Not an unfair deal. Now, you would still have problems in connection.
Politically indefensible for committed Western government.
That's why you do it secretly, you see. That's why you do it secretly, and it'll take 10 years before you publish it. So what I'm doing is just to contribute to having ideas like that float in the air.
Mm.
Now, let us add to that 10,000 dialogues of civil society. Let doctors meet doctors. IPPNW, I'm thinking of that brilliant organization of physicians against nuclear war and so on. Very trained negotiators, many of them. Let lawyers make lawyers. Let anybody meet anybody. Let
elderly professors meet elderly professors.
Not to mention radio muggles. Meet radio muggles. Let all muggles meet. You know, they're used to muggles in that part of the world. They usually came from Mongolia. So, if you look at it that way, the 10,000 dialogues blossom.
Yeah.
If we were willing to say we have a deficit in knowledge of Islam, could you please come and teach us? And we're not going to accept it unchallenged. We're going to put you on the air once a week.
And we're going to be critical about the way you treat women, but we will
absolutely
listen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is why we cannot have unlimited respect. Unlimited respect, no. But respect for your faith, if you treat women better, yes. Now, they have answers to that one, you see. They say that you people, you think that women and men are created exactly the same way. You haven't discovered some differences. And that's why you say everyone. Now, we believe that rights of women and rights of men are somewhat different and complementary. And then we say, ha, so that's your pretext for suppressing them. And they say, look, in the 1980s you passed the rights of women. That means that you yourselves have come to that conclusion. If you take that declaration and you compare it with other views we have within dialogue distance. Now, I've been checking that. There's dialogue distance.
But and there are ears wanting to listen.
There are ears wanting to listen on both sides. A little 861... show a little willingness, a little recognition, an understanding of their history, an openness, a curiosity, ask questions. They will embrace you.
What are you doing in Australia? Let me ask you this finally. I see you're at Curtin, your latest university.
I'm, of course, studying Australian hedonism. I'm studying Little Creatures beer, and I have studies in depth of Plantagenet wines. Now, after my studies, I have landed on those two. I find the talent, as I mentioned, of enjoyment in Australia absolutely unique in the world. It's Anglo-Celtic. It's Anglo-rationality and Celtic emotionality. Not a bad combination.
But you've also pointed out there's a lack of intellectual rigour in our political life.
I haven't seen any sign of that. In the present life, I noticed that the possible new Prime Minister has written a very respectable book. Now, professors pay a little bit too much attention to books of that type. Latham certainly has the intellectual rigour. Whether that goes well with the Australian public, I don't know. But there is a deficit of knowledge. And as far as I understand, you people in the media have some of the responsibility for that.
I take it all upon myself, actually. It's my fault.
I've seen worse cases than Philip Adams. But let me say, I just enjoy it fully. Curtin University, my friend Jim Ife and I, we are writing a book together on globalization of human rights. We try to give globalization a good word. And I myself am working day and night editing some new books.
Look, it's the best and worst of things, globalization, isn't it?
Precisely.
It offers great benefactions
that we've got to look at.
Mm.
But if it is monopolized by a gang of businessmen from one race and one gender and one generation and one nation, mainly Anglo-Saxon, used to running the world with a couple of people chiming into it, then you get a parody of it. And you get 100,000 persons dying per day, as we do right now. Not all of it due to the global market, but 26,000 of starvation, the rest of easily curable and preventable diseases, but not affordable.
You've been listening to the old peace horse, Johann Geltel. I have to say that I found the last
fascinating, because you're a formidable old fellow, aren't you?
Well, you kindly call me old. I prefer the word older, if I may put it that way. And I'm never retired from anything, because I interpret the word retired as meaning you'll be tired again and again and again. And I do research, which means searching again and again and again. I work hard. There's much work behind it.
And it's fun, isn't it?
Without a sense of humor, you can never make it. Because if you don't have that, you can't get on top of something, which is quite often quite agonizing.
And on that uplifting and happy note, we shall take our leave of each other. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you.
Professor Johann Geltung. And now I want to mention what's happening next week. I'll be in the Solomon Islands over there to practice what I've learned from Johann. We're going to sort things out once and for all. We'll be gathering a heap of material for LNL, which we'll play over subsequent weeks. On Monday, we'll have a program from Honiara, which will involve a couple of the island's most distinguished political and cultural figures, talking about, well, just how the Solomon Islands reached a point where it had to ask for outside help to restore civil society. And for the rest of the week, we'll be playing some special requests, including Al Franken, Warren Mitchell, and Olfet Mahmood, among others. Let me thank the team for another week: Marianne Keady, Chris Short, Annabel Quince, Joe Upham, Paul Gough, and Chris Bullock. And Chris, can I borrow your malaria tablets? See you later.